Welcome to the beautiful Joan and Robert Rechnick's Theater right here at Two River Theater in Red Bank. Joan and Robert, I believe, are joining us tonight. I'm WBGO News Director Doug Doyle, and tonight we will be talking about the upcoming production of Lorraine Hansberry's famous play, A Raisin in the Sun, which made its Broadway debut all the way back in 1959, a play the New York Times said changed American theater forever. Powerful words from the New York Times. Joining me on stage tonight is the director of this production, which runs from September 9th through October 8th. Please welcome the award-winning New York-based director and actor, Carl Cofield. Carl's directing credits include the 50th anniversary of The Dutchman for the Classical Theater of Harlem, National Black Theater, The Tempest, Macbeth, just to name a few. His Master's of Fine Arts comes from Columbia. Welcome, Carl.
Thank you.
Now, many of you know A Raisin in the Sun focuses on the Younger family, that's their last name, Younger, and their dreams. And those who are playing the roles of that family, we have three actors tonight joining us who you are very familiar with. All have been favorites here at Two River Theater. In the role of Mama, Lena Younger, is the amazing Brenda Presley. Brenda, come on out. Brenda starred in Trouble in Mind and in this house here at Two River. Broadway, The Lions, Cats, Dreamgirls, just a few big shows, right? Just a little, just to name a few. Playing Ruth Younger is the fabulous stage and TV actress Crystal A. Dickinson. Crystal. Ah, yes, that famous family that keeps coming back to Two River Theater, right? Crystal Dickinson starred in Seven Guitars here at Two River. Broadway, You Can't Take It With You, Clybourne Park, and others. Here's a stranger to you, Brandon J. Durden. Has anybody ever heard of him? You know, he's graced us both as an actor and director here at Two River, most recently on Broadway in August Wilson's Jitney. He's directed Seven Guitars here. He starred last year in Ma Rainey's Black Bottom. Your Blues Ain't Sweet Like Mine. Brandon plays the role of Walter Lee Younger, Ruth's husband, I should say. And Brandon and Crystal, as you might know, are married in real life. Maybe a little different in real life than what they'll be in the show, right? A Raisin in the Sun, by the way, comes from a Langston Hughes poem entitled Harlem, also known as A Dream Deferred. And in that poem, it says, what happens to a dream deferred? Does it dry up like a raisin in the sun? That's just part of the poem and where the playwright got her inspiration. Carl, we know that Walter and Ruth Younger, their son Travis, along with Walter's mother, Lena, they're in Chicago's South Side, not really well off. But something happens to this family that really causes dreams to be talked about, dreams crushed, dreams possibly realized, a $10,000 insurance check payout following the death of the father in the family. There's other characters we will talk about tonight in the show. Give us your sense of the synopsis of A Raisin in the Sun for those who haven't had a chance to see the play.
Well, it, as you said, we open up and we discover the Youngers right after the death of Big Walter, the father. In a last act, he's left the family with a $10,000 insurance policy check. And to put that in perspective, this is 1950. So an equivalent would be something like $100,000 today. So we watch the family grapple with the idea of how to best use this money. And they're competing dreams. Little Walter has dreams of becoming a businessman. Mama has dreams of owning a piece of property, a little house. And so we watched them grapple with the best way to use this money. And over the course of, over the play, compelling arguments come from both sides. And there's one other character, Benita, who's the younger sister. And she also has dreams. She's currently training to become a medical doctor. So all of these things come into conflict, and we find ultimately we know that they do in fact move and integrate a neighborhood. And you know, I think it's something that always strikes me today, the courage that that would take to be the first, to be the pioneer, to endure sort of these hardships. So to me, that's one of the most compelling things about the story, watching this family navigate, cry together, laugh together, and through it all have this type of love that we joke today is not the romantic R&B love that is sort of cheap, but the real love. The real love that costs and is rich and is beautiful and is hard and as ugly and as complex as love should be. So to me, that is the overall, the compelling thing that resonates with me the most about the story.
So Carl and Phil Free are actors on stage. Seems to be amazing that a play that starred and started on Broadway in 1959 could be relevant today, but with what has happened most recently with the violence in Charlottesville, Virginia, can you talk about the relevance of A Raisin in the Sun in today's world?
Yeah, I definitely do. And I think whenever I approach a project, I always ask, how is this relevant to a 21st century audience? And to me, in a time where wealth inequality, civilness is on a low end, and really having conversations and being able to talk to people, this is one of the most profound stories that I've come in contact with. We look at a black family in a 360-degree holistic view, not a two-dimensional, one-dimensional, stereotypical depiction, but a really complicated, as we all are complicated. One day I could be totally in favor for something else, and I'm complicated. The next day, I'm not. And that is what I believe Lorraine Hansberry captures so beautifully in this piece, the conflicting ideas. So how it's relevant in a 21st century audience, and especially what's going on now, is fear. Fear, courage, love, empathy. These are all the themes that resonate when I read the play and watch these amazing actors in rehearsal. And I think that's what we need more of. And to me, that is the job of art, to hold that mirror up to society and ask these big questions. So no matter if we look at the Greeks, we look at Shakespeare, we look at Lorraine Hansberry, we look at August Wilson, the big things are, what are the questions they are asking? And for me, it is, what price do we pay? How deep is our love, and how deep is our trust, and what are the bonds that unite us? And we found out in rehearsal that this family has a wonderful elasticity. So they can argue and they can pick at each other. They can go away from one another, but they are family. And the only thing that separated Ruth and Big Walter was the undertaker. What separates us a lot today our tweets. It's a much realer type of love that said, if I am with you to the end, I am with you until they wheel me away.
Mm-hmm. I would also add that Lorraine Hansberry considered herself not just a playwright, but an activist. And this play is an example of her activism, and I think she would say that herself. And the question is, what happens to a dream deferred? And we're still asking that question. So I think that's the relevance, that we're still asking that question.
Right, and I think there are a lot of acts of activism throughout the course of history, even particularly our very short American history, that were of its time and have since been considered passé and not relevant today. But what makes this particularly, this act of activism particularly relevant today is the brilliance of Lorraine Hansberry to not just comment on a time, the 1950s in America, but what she is really unearthing is a deep truth about humanity. And anytime you excavate the truths about humanity, it will forever be relevant in whatever time we're in. And it's the truth that she excavates about race relations in America in this particular play are unfortunately, yes, still timely. Yes. But what it does for me today, I'm so happy that this play is so good that theaters want to still present it. And even after, oh, please, God, one day, even after we can say, yes, the race relations here in America have so improved that we don't have to have the same conversations that we've been having for the last 400 years. Even when we get to that point, we will still present A Raisin in the Sun because of the complex humanity and the other ideas that go along with it. But specifically, what she points out and what she highlights about race relations in America, why I'm particularly excited to be presenting this play, is that I think younger generations and even people who aren't so young, I think we have been conditioned to, if somebody didn't tweet about it today, then it's old news, right? So we're fooled into thinking that we're moving a lot faster than we are, because of the speed of information and the different ways of information as it comes at us, right? And so we have this whiplash of sorts in today's society about how and where our information is coming from. And so I think when we take a look at a piece that is so outstanding like A Raisin in the Sun, and we see, oh my gosh, what has changed, we realize we're not moving at that lightning fast pace towards peace, towards unity, towards understanding of each other, towards empathy, towards love of someone who's not directly related to you by blood. We aren't moving as fast as we could be moving. And I think this play is a reminder of that, don't be fooled. Don't be fooled just because of the speed of the information that you're getting.
And she's asking, when I say about a dream deferred, we're talking about very specifically the American dream, what that means to be American and what that means to have prosperity or to be promised whatever America promises you. And I think we're still asking ourselves that question of what happens when some people think they deserve that and some people do not, or some people don't get it. And we were talking in rehearsal today and just saying how, today even we're saying we're going to build a wall because there are people who are not like us who shouldn't come here and get our dream. Like, that dream is for us. That dream is not for, whoever is on the other side of that wall. So we're asking that question, I think, in a lot of ways, complicated ways still today.
Brenda Presley, Lorraine Hansberry died at the age of 34, 1965. She said that A Raisin in the Sun was genuine realism that pits, as you mentioned, Carl, sympathy versus conflict. So as Mama, your character, you really face that. But you teach us so much about love and pride. Can you describe what your Lena Younger will actually bring to the stage right here?
The role of Lena Younger is so brilliantly written. The text is right there. And if you surrender your artistry to the beautiful words written to form this beautiful woman who is so universal, that is what I hope I will bring to the role. It's right there. Lena Younger is so regal, and it is so humbling, exciting, intimidating all to play Lena Younger, I would think, for any actress. But she wears her race, her gender, her role as mother, as if there were a crown upon her head and majestic robes around her shoulders. Mm-hmm. And I think that is the blueprint, The text is there. You have wonderful actors with you, with the journey, on the journey. And it's almost like butter. I had a wonderful mother. I was nurtured by wonderful, wonderful women in my life. One is still alive. She is 103 years old. And just knowing how they approached their roles as African-American women, as upright citizens of their world, as wonderful mothers, I think if I keep all of that in mind as I go along this journey as Lena here on this wonderful stage with my wonderful castmates, I'll be just fine. And I think Ms. Hansberry will be able to smile and say, okay, well
What
done.
Was going on in your mind, as you mentioned, when you were a teenager, when you first saw Raisin in the Sun?
I saw Miss Claudia McNeil portray Lena Younger, and what a formidable presence she had in the role. And as formidable as she was, there was a gentleness about her. You couldn't miss that thing of she breathed for each and every person in that apartment. She loved them fiercely. She demanded the very best of them and just would not accept anything but the very best from each and every person. And so that stays with you. I mean, to see an African-American actress portray such a wonderful role to begin with, it leaves quite an impression. But, the strength along with the compassion.
We're here at Two River Theater in Red Bank, the Recknitz Theater, talking about A Raisin in the Sun. Brandon J. Durden plays Walter Younger, been played by some of the most famous actors in the biz, from Sidney Poitier to Ossie Davis to Danny Glover, whether it be on stage, television. Brandon, how are you approaching this role, this complicated and frustrated man, to better his family, but he's got so many barriers to deal with?
Sure. he does have a lot of barriers. Great roles like Walter Lee and great plays like A Raisin in the Sun, they make space for any actor who approaches it. They make so much space for you, they dare you to bring all of yourself. It dares you to bring everything, and then it asks for more. And that's what this play does. So I'm preparing myself to be available, to learn more about myself. The text is there. The text is not going to change. But I expect to change as a human. I do. I expect to learn more from this role. I expect this role to teach me more about myself than I can teach the play about what the play is, if you understand what I'm saying. And I hope that all those great actors that you mentioned had the same experience, because I think it's a real opportunity and it's a gift to know that that's about to happen. That's the journey. And it's happening already with 2 or 3 days of rehearsal. So I don't know what I'm going to bring different other than myself, and I'm different from those actors.
Yeah, do you actually watch their performances, or do you just say, I know what the show is about, and then you create your character from yourself? Do you take bits and pieces of these people?
I don't take bits and pieces. I've watched both of those. Well, I haven't seen Ossie Davis play Walter Younger. I've definitely seen Sidney and Poitier and Danny Glover's version, and the most recent Denzel version on Broadway, and Sean Combs, the television version for that. And sure, I learned something every time about the role, but I learned their Walter Lee. And within the context of that family, if I were to try and repeat what Sidney Poitier was doing, it wouldn't work, because I have the great Brenda Presley playing Mama. I don't have, that mother. And so it wouldn't ring true. I mean, I could say, I think those great artists can unlock an understanding about the man himself, but it wouldn't fit within this puzzle. You understand what I'm saying? So I think the real challenge, this is an ensemble piece.
Yes, it is.
And you sometimes you forget that until you see it again with a great ensemble. And what you're going to see here at Two River is a great ensemble. And so you're going to leave thinking, yeah, Walter, but yes, Benita, but yes, Ruth, but yes, Lena, but yes, Travis, but yes, Asagai, but yes, George, but yes, Bobo. You know, you're going to know something about every single one of these individuals who you get to meet when you come and see this show.
And I would also add to this that Brandon and I have seen probably together at least four stage productions of this, and in addition to the movies that we've seen all, you know, around the country, pales in comparison to doing it. It doesn't even, like, you are not, you realize, okay, watching it is an experience in itself, and you have a different relationship with it. And anybody who loves theater in America knows this play and has a relationship with this play. You have to, or else don't call yourself a theater professional, because you just have to. But that experience pales in comparison to being in this play and committing to this play, like Brandon said. It asks every single part of you. It asks for you as a citizen of this country. It asks you to do something as, you know, just in your own personal life. And all my life, I think probably, you know, little black girls want to be Benita. As far as I know, you know, we want to play Benita because you're like, oh, you know, she's so, you know, she wants to be a doctor. And she's got these callers and she's, you know. And but then, you know, you're introduced to this world and you realize that the calling of it is much greater than just that. It's just more complicated than that. And you begin to take on a different position. It's like you're being inside the belly of a beast.
Yes.
Yeah. But it's a safe place to be in that belly.
It's a safe place.
What I'm really finding out every day, and I knew this from watching the play, I've never seen a production of this. I don't care how talented or untalented the actors were, I've never seen a production where I was not immensely moved. I mean, I could probably watch a basement full of geriatrics do, you know, this play. And
nothing wrong with geriatrics now. We're not saying nothing about that.
No. I think I could,
they
though.
Fly.
I could definitely watch it. Or toddlers. I could watch toddlers as long as they say the words that Lorraine Hansberry wrote and be extremely moved by this play. And it's only because of this. It's only because what I'm finding out every day in rehearsal is how much Lorraine Hansberry loved us. She loves every single character she wrote. And she loved us enough to expose our flaws. But she doesn't leave us there. She never leaves anyone broken. Not even you, the audience, as you watch this. She's going to break you, but she's not going to leave you broken. And there's so much love for these people and for the people she is asking to watch this journey. She loves you. And she wants you to be a better you when you walk out of this theater.
You know, as we hear Brandon talk like we did last year, hard to believe that he would be cast as Martin Luther King Jr. in any type of play, right? Just doesn't have a way with words at all. The Mountaintop, you directed The Mountaintop. You also received a LA NAACP Award for Best Director, Carl. Mountaintop, you did for the Cleveland Playhouse. Civil rights, obviously, something that touches you deeply. Is that what drew you to want to be director of this play? How did that all work out?
No, absolutely. You know, as a to piggyback on what Crystal was saying, to be a black theater maker, A Raisin in the Sun is definitely on your, you know, short list. That is how you are measured, more or less, as a black theater maker. And to also couple up with what Brandon was saying, this play changes anyone who comes in contact with it. I've read the play, I think, not exaggerating, 4 million times. No, I don't.
That's a lot.
Maybe it's a little puffery, but it gets me every single time. Every single time. And to Brandon's point, I think what the theater demands of us is to be participants, right? Not just casual spectators or observers. So when you come in here and deal with the Youngers for 2.5 hours, I defy you not to be changed. Mm-hmm. I defy you. I don't think it can be done. It's just that, I can't even think of the word, but it affects you on so many levels.
There's an alchemy there.
There is a magic there that I think only can happen in the theater because of the ritual of coming to the theater. It's almost like going to church for those of you who use, talk about things in a religious way, but there's a ritual. We're in the same room, breathing the same air, exhaling while they're inhaling, and vice versa. There's a magic that only can happen in this theater when these actors recite this beautiful, beautiful text.
Crystal A. Dickinson, you know, I think people might have the misconception, and correct me if I'm wrong, that it would be easy to play the wife of someone you're really married to. But as Brandon has said, he's going to change. He's actually going to change during the run of this play. So the fact that you're Ruth Younger, what will you take from your real life marriage into this marriage?
But you know what? These two people, Ruth and Walter, love each other. They love each other with an undying love. We meet them. When we meet them, it's not going well. It's not going well between them. And the two find a way. But there is love there. And so I think what I take from my own marriage and what I'm going to use and what, and vice versa, is that it's possible to to dislike the person that you are married to and still love the person fiercely. And that's easy to do. It's easy. Brandon's easy to love, so it's not hard. You know, that's not hard.
You get to
it's not hard in real
point.
Life. It's not hard in fake life. It's not hard.
But she does have a practice in disliking.
Yes, I do.
That's a gift I've given her in preparation for this role.
Such a gift.
I can understand that. Brenda, what is the American dream today, and has it changed since these characters wanted it so badly?
I think the American dream has not changed. We want comfort. We want happiness. We want a success in being the very best selves that we can be, and for that to be true for the people whom we love. That doesn't change. That's universal. And I've been saying maybe a couple of times in rehearsal, those kinds of things can be felt in Pakistan, China, across the street, anywhere you go. You see the same kinds of, you can see the same kinds of feelings of love and devotion and vision with families. You just can. And that is the beauty of our humanity. That's the beauty of our being in a world where, yes, we have different religions and ways of dealing with day-to-day life, but pure love and devotion, it's the same. And so, no, nothing has changed that way. You know, we have tweets and whatever going on left and right. We distance ourselves a bit, I think, from each other now. And life circumstances, unfortunately. But when it all comes stripped down, it's the same. And so, yeah, dreams are as they were 1,000 years ago.
Brandon, as I prepared for our interview, I thought of just how amazing you were as Booster in Jitney. You know, you've directed 7 guitars here at Two River. You brought us to tears in Ma Rainey's Black Bottom. I'd like your comparison between August Wilson and Lorraine Hansberry.
Wow, it's so funny you mention that, because in rehearsals recently we've been I've drawn several parallels to August Wilson's piano lesson, right? You know, we have at the heart of piano lesson is what do we do with this family heirloom, this piano? How are we going to go forward in the future? Boy Willie wants to sell it to have money to buy land to move his family forward, and Bernice wants to hold on to it for sentimental reasons, and, you know, and the way it identifies the family. And it's not an exact comparison with this $10,000 check, but there is debate. What are we going to do with this money, this inheritance, as the piano was an inheritance in that family? And it's striking to me how many times as we're discussing A Raisin in the Sun, it hits me. Oh, right, that was Boy Willie's journey in this. And Piano Lesson was written 35 years after A Raisin in the Sun. But what I can say about August Wilson is the same thing I say about Lorraine Hansberry and his love for our people, his love for us, his love for his characters, right? And that is, and I think when you have that much love and you're writing about people, you're going to see those similarities, right? It's not strange that Boy Willie is drawn from the same well as Walter Lee Younger. It's not far-fetched that these two young men who are striving to have that piece of Americana, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Come hell or high water, damn, whatever obstacle is in my way, I'm going to take that shot, right? And I think we're going to find other playwrights, not just these two, but other playwrights, as you write about our conquest, or as you write about our pursuit of the American dream, you'll be able to draw these characters in the future. You'll be able to draw the lines between Walter Lee, the Boy Willies, and let's say the character in Dominic Morisot's Skeleton Crew that my brother Jason Durden played, and you can draw lines to that character, right? But not just these men. Let's look at other playwrights that aren't writing necessarily about the African American experience.
That's
right. So it would do us all a disservice to simply look at the parallels between Lorraine Hansberry and August Wilson as, oh, that's something separate. And I think that's what Lorraine Hansberry is trying to tell us in this play. When you look at Walter Lee, just don't look at this. Don't look at this as a specific, even though it is a specific experience of the African-American people here in this country. She wants you to say, that's my son.
Absolutely.
And what would my son would want to do that too? Or that's my mother, or that's my sister. You know?
But I think both playwrights are asking, these men, Boy Willie and Walter Lee, are asking, why don't I deserve it? Yes. Am I not American? Do I not have this blood? Do I not have this heritage? Do I not own what this country promises? Why am I not deserving of it? What have I done to put me at a disadvantage? Mm-hmm. And they've done nothing except be black. And that's just the truth, you know? And we have to, and I think in order to progress in this country, we have to be real and answer that question truthfully and say, yes, we have not afforded you what we promised you. And then move forward.
You said in these roles they change you. How did Booster change you?
Booster in August Wilson's Jitney is, well, we have a young man who committed a crime of passion. Well, I wouldn't even call it a crime of passion. Not passion in the sense of he loved this woman so much that he killed her when she was wronged. But his passion for right, and I think here's a young man who went so far in his pursuit of honor and rightness and that he went too far in a lot of people's opinion, but then he owned up to it. So it changed me in saying, when I, as a young, ambitious actor or a father or a husband, when I go too far in my pursuit of being right and I overstep the bounds of respect for either my son, my wife, my parents, do I have the courage to own up to that? And then forgive myself and try to move forward with life. And I think Booster had that, and he taught me that. No matter how far you go, you own up to it, and then you move forward.
Speaking of Broadway, Carl, you know, when Raisin in the Sun came to Broadway, there were detractors thinking, you know, as far as they didn't know if this was going to be a successful run. Why did this play win, nominated for four Tony Awards? It had to be that much more excellent, didn't it, in order to grab the attention at that time?
You know, that's a great question, and I think, we struggle with the inherited myths that get passed down about what will work and the way things are supposed to work, and it's always the pioneer, whether it be in theater like this play, or we're finding out now that movies like Girls Trip and Hidden Figures that don't necessarily comport themselves to what the classic inherited myth model about how to make a Hollywood film and what you need. But when you actually do it and you put it out there and it is supremely well done, things like that can happen. I don't know if that really answers your question, but I can definitely see the parallels of... we were talking today, and Brandon, you might want to jump in on this, about one of the plays that came before A Raisin in the Sun, Alice Childress.
Trouble in Mind.
And how come that play wasn't the, excuse the sports reference, the Jackie Robinson of Broadway?
Trouble in Mind had been produced off-Broadway in New York and was a huge hit and ran for months off-Broadway. And the money was there, the investors were there, the producers were ready to take it to Broadway. But they needed Alice Childress to change the ending. I mean, Trouble of Mind was produced here at Two River, which Brenda Presley starred in. So some of the audiences may be familiar with that, and hopefully New York audiences will get to be familiar with that play. Real, so I think in my lifetime, it is a great mission of mine, no matter how. I would love for that play to eventually have its Broadway premiere. But the producers needed Alice Childress to change the ending, to make it seem as the, to share the culpability. Whereas play as she had written, I, in my opinion, and in a lot of the Broadway producers' opinions, felt that it laid too much of the blame on the white director. It's a play within the play. So one of the characters, it laid too much of the blame on the white characters in the play, right? And so Alice Childress rewrote this ending several times until she couldn't recognize her own play, and she says, "To hell with this! I can't sanction this play to be produced on Broadway anymore." And they couldn't come to terms, and then 5 years later, we had A Raisin in the Sun, which premiered. Now we're learning now that so many additions. And subtractions from Raising the Sun. So we have different copies of Raising the Sun in rehearsal. We're like, well, I wonder why they changed this word. I wonder why this scene was cut. Or I wonder why this. And there are editor's notes about, well, we had to, in certain productions, we had to consider the commercial viability of the production. And so, therefore, some scenes were omitted or other words were changed. But we don't know the details, but we know that was a consideration.
Did you want to make any mention of that, Brenda?
Well, when you asked why A Raisin in the Sun could not be denied those four Tony nominations and all, because it is so brilliantly written, it cannot be denied. It is indeed a masterpiece. It still lives just as relevant and moving and magnificent today as it was then. You can't deny greatness. You just cannot. I don't care what kind of wrapping it comes in. I don't care what kind of color is at the helm. You cannot deny it. You may try, but you can't. Thank God for that.
This is not a three-person play. So, Carl, can you talk about the rest of the cast of A Raisin in the Sun?
We have an extraordinary cast. I mean, we have a stellar company of actors, York, Jasmine, Owen, geez, who else am I leaving now? Charlie Hudson III, who you might remember from. Nat is here. Willie. Oh, and of course. Willie,
he's here.
Willie Dearden, which is a coup in and of itself. We have the Dearden men on stage. I think the first father and son duo in Two River history. I think that's correct. So it is, it's an extraordinary company that I have the utmost pleasure to be collaborating with. Because I got to tell you, I wish they were all like this. There's some days you go into a process and you have to sort of manufacture the enthusiasm. This is not one of those projects. This is a project that has been on my calendar, circled, red, high lit, big font, italicized, and it's living up to every ounce of it.
And I think we all could say that. I think that is, I mean, without, sometimes, it, you know, these things are, you know, but it, that is an absolute truth. It has been a pleasure. We've only had three days?
Two and a half days.
But the commitment of every single person,
yes.
Not just to their themselves, but to the work, to learn Hansberry, has been exhausting.
I was just about to say.
And
We just started.
You know, Two River Theater has magnificent production staff. And I mean, it's just a magnificent theater, from the person who cleans up this stage to the person who is in charge, John Diaz. They're magnificent people. And they continue to ask us whenever they see us, how's it going? How you doing? And I'm like, I'm tired. I'm great, but I'm tired. Because it asks so much of you. And in this climate that we're living in, where we're asking ourselves, what is going on in America?
Yes.
What are we doing to ourselves here? What's happening? Where is the love? Like, you know, and we're processing those things that we hear in the news, and then we have to come and talk about them, and then we have to act them out.
I think that's probably why we are feeling just a little bit more gravitas. I mean, we can't help but feel a little bit more weighed down. Around the table, we're just getting from around the table. We will be up on our feet for the first time tomorrow, which is kind of a speedy kind of process, all things considered. But we have only been around the table reading the play and exploring all of the nuances, just, you know, as a brand new family of actors. And it has been exhausting.
And it does, this play, unlike some plays, it really does ask you to tap into your personal experience,
yes,
as a person of color in this country, or not, like, because Nat is the same thing. I think Nat is going through the same thing that we are going through.
Nat plays Carl Lindner, the sole Caucasian in the play.
Yeah, but I think it just asks you to say, where have you been denied, or what are the hopes that you have? Where do you meet this country? Like, where do you stand? Where are your ideas about it? How do you feel about being an American? What does that mean to you to be American? What do you think you deserve as an American? What are you denied as an American? And we're asking these questions for 6 hours a day.
And as I was preparing to come to rehearsal today, there was footage of the mother who had to speak of her child who was murdered this past weekend. I believe her name is Susan Brough, her daughter Heather Heyer. And she stood at a podium and proclaimed her child as a martyr. And with her head held high, she was able to celebrate her child's purpose in what had happened and the role that her child will play forevermore in this country's history. And I thought of Lena Younger. And Susan Brough may not even know of Lena Younger, but I saw Lena standing there at that podium, a mother who fiercely loved her child, so very proud of her child, even in those circumstances that she found herself in. But, you know, that being that formidable presence as mother. So,
you had mentioned the character of Carl Lindner, and in the show, he's trying to prevent the Younger family from moving into primarily an all-white neighborhood and doing everything he can to convince and offering money to stay away. What do you think happens to the Younger family when they say, no, we're moving in? Now, Clybourne Park, you know, you played in that, Crystal. So let's start with you. Where do you think the Younger family goes, and what kind of experience did you think happened once they moved into that neighborhood?
We actually, you asked such wonderful questions, because we just talked about this today. Because that was a big question to me before we read the end of the play today. I said, the playwright herself was one family in an all-white neighborhood. And she tells of how she was beaten up as a young child, how bricks were thrown through her family's home, one nearly missing her head, I think, once. And I said, you know, she endured all that. And then she writes a play where poor Travis has to endure the same thing. Travis is going to go and get his tail beat, right? I said, why would she do that? And then we read the end of the play, and I thought, what I'd come up with is that this is a family, very much like what you're saying about this young woman of being a martyr, a pioneer, or this family is that. And what is going to help them get through that is the love that they have, the strength that they have as a family. As any family get, like how we get through hard things as we stick together. And so I believe, unfortunately, that it's not going to go well. It's not going to be pleasant. But what I do think is that they're going to endure it. That's what I think.
And I was thinking today, Doug, about this. Is it's not just like what happens when they move to this Claiborne Park. Not just that, but what happens if they don't?
Absolutely.
What does that say about the character of this family who now has the means to better themselves and better their environment, but they choose not to out of fear of what might happen? What does that say about our character? Right? So sometimes it's not, oh, I'm afraid of what's on the other side. I'm afraid of the evils that are known, because we do have stories. I mean, it is documented, the bombings that happened to these families that tried to integrate these neighborhoods, the intimidation. Those are well-documented stories, right? So it's not like we don't have an understanding of what may come. But what is scarier is, what does that say about us as a people if we don't take this opportunity?
Absolutely. And the funny thing about it is, I mean, not funny, but in the play, Ruth, I ask where it is, where are we moving? And she says Claiborne Park, and she goes, couldn't you find another place for us to live? Like, there weren't any other houses. There's no black people there. Two lines later, she goes, well, I guess if that's where we're moving, we're moving. And everybody else just goes along. We don't have a long, drug-out conversation about, oh, it's going to be scary. What are we going to do with Travis? And maybe we should get by. It doesn't happen. We move forward. Yes, this is what we're doing. There's as far as I can understand about this family, it's like that fear is not there. They like Brandon said, they understand what they're going to be met with, and yet they go forward.
Yeah, and I just to piggyback on that what I think happens is the struggle continues, and it's still met with courage. Courage is a muscle, and if you don't use it, it atrophies. And this family knows about using courage to go into the lion's den armed with faith, courage, and love. The struggle will be real, as the kids say on the street today, but they're going to get through it.
And I think that's what maybe, in a lot of ways, that Lorraine Hansberry wants us to leave with, what Brandon was saying, how at the end you're going to be changed. And I think that's what she's trying to say. She's trying to say, with faith and with courage and with love, as a country, we can do this. It's possible. It's going to be hard, not going to be pretty, but doable, possible, if we're yeah, willing to have the courage, faith, and love to do so.
And it's not going to be done by staying where you are.
Right.
And that's both ways.
Both ways.
It's not going to be done by staying comfortably locked in your ivory tower either. You've got to move. You've got to move to those uncomfortable places.
And even if that uncomfortable place means that I've been enjoying a privilege that other people don't have, if that means you have to answer and say that and hold yourself accountable to that, so be it. But on the other side of that is something better if we could only have the courage to believe that.
Brandon J. Durden, I know that you know your history. There wouldn't be a Lorraine Hansberry. There wouldn't be a Raisin in the Sun if it wasn't for Carl Hansberry, because he was the one who pushed all the way to the Supreme Court to have the right to move into a neighborhood such as that. If you had an opportunity, and Carl was sitting right where your wife is right now, what would you want to say to Carl Hansberry?
Thank you. thank you, and can I buy you a drink? And tell me how to do it. Tell me what is. I would ask him what is the fight today that you see that's worth fighting, and what would be your approach to fighting that fight?
How about you, Brenda?
I would say thank you. And if he could give me a little insight as to how you garner that kind of courage to have your focus unwavered, and I don't know, your faith just right there in the palm of your hand, that you're all not all knowing, but full of courage and the will to get it done.
Yeah, you're talking about courage because we're talking about the Supreme Court decision was 1940.
Absolutely.
So we're not talking, what it was like back then.
Absolutely.
Oh, Brandon and I, we have a 3-year-old who is in the audience.
Chase.
And I think I would ask him, as a parent, I would want to know the fear. I mean, what was his concern, or how did he, first of all, how did he raise this amazing child? Like, what did you do, or how did you navigate that, given knowing what you were going to give up, knowing what your child would have to endure? How did you do it?
Carl, I want to know a little bit more what is inside you, because we just met tonight, right? Is there a moment, have you met somebody, have you had an experience where you face discrimination or racism that has led you to have a fire in you that won't quit?
Yeah, not the flippant answer would be I live with that daily, whether it be through microaggressions, whether it be going to schools where I was the only person of color, but I can say, honestly, that theater, this art form, saved my life. And I think that's why it's so I'm so passionate about it.
Can you tell us about that?
Well, I just grew up in a household that valued the three things that the younger family values: God, family, and education. And those things were those were the tenets that my mother just insisted upon more so than anything else. Luckily for me, art was also part of it, because art to me was not how the world really was. When I walked outside, everyone can see what the world looks like, but art left room to say what the world could be like, and it allowed me to use the imagination. And for me, finding stories of marginalized people of color like myself, whether it's a book, whether it's a song, you see yourself in the art. And that was something that, at a young age of 4, seeing, James Earl Jones do King Lear and saying, oh my God, I never thought it could be done like that. You mean to tell me that a black man could be the king of this? That was the spark that led the curiosity. So that is what I also have 2 young boys. And in my own way, trying to find, we talked about it today, there's no owner's manual for being a parent. There's no owner's manual. You build the jet and you fly it at the same time. So you're just trying to do the best you can. But hopefully to pass on and be the custodian of our cultural legacy is something that drives me. And not have my narrative dictated without my control in it, without my hand in my gumbo, if that makes sense.
Doug, I'm going to cut you off here, but I'm sure Carl has his stories about being discriminated against, and I have mine, and Brenda and Crystal will have theirs, and probably every person of color in this room will have theirs, and they have value. They have value in sharing, and there's value in you hearing our stories. But I think right now, today, what I particularly most interested in is Doug, as a white man, what are those stories that you have that light a fire under your belly to, to challenge racism in this country? I mean, Lorraine gives us one in this play, Carl Lindner, right? She gives us a man with honorable intentions who comes in here, and he has an experience. And I don't know how he's changed when he leaves his house, but he has an experience, right? So I think I think what's really valuable in today's context, in today's society, are those who identify in the majority group. What are those stories that compel you to speak out against, to fight, to right the wrongs? I mean, I'm interested in that.
Yeah, well, I mean, valid point. And I think that not only, you know, for me to answer that, but every person, you know, who comes to this show should be asking themselves the same question as they leave the Recknitz Theater. You know, how does this impact you? When I'm watching the play, and I watched it several times in different casts from Broadway to off-Broadway, and my thought was, for the Lindner character, was he was such a buffoon by now to me. He was a character that I would be ashamed that if I knew this person, that I would love to sit down and talk to them and say, you really are going to try to buy them off? You really feel that this family cannot exist in this neighborhood? We see, though, that I'm not the person who feels, you know, just, we see a lot of people who don't feel like me, that they look at Lindner and say, yeah, he's my friend. Yeah, that's exactly how I feel to this day, you know, where, you know, it's difficult sometimes to watch some of my favorite films and plays, you know, watching and knowing that the lone white person in this play, to me, is a joke of a person. That hurts me. That hurts me inside deeply because he's representing me, right? And that's Lorraine's portrayal of me. And so that's hurtful. You certainly know when I say what's hurtful, but it comes right back to me, you know?
Well, come watch this one. Come watch this one.
I think you'll be pleasantly surprised with this production.
I was going to.
As far as Carl Lindner is concerned.
Going back to Clybourne Park. So Bruce Norris, the playwright of Clybourne Park, he told us that in his school when he was a young person, 10 or whatever, every year, once a year, they would watch Raisin in the Sun as like some kind of like, I don't know, what would you call it, like a education, an education. And he wrote Clybourne Park because he said, well, that's the part I could play. In his mind, he said, well, that's the part I could play, but what happens to that guy? So from there, we have another play that won a Pulitzer Prize.
Yes,
And the only play in history to win the Olivier, the Pulitzer Prize, and the Tony.
One thing I would say about Lindner, and maybe you know, Nat plays that, but I'd like to see a little, he's kind of meek, you know, and so I'd like to see a strong guy get to be the same rotten person, you know? He's kind of meek, and so, like, you can kind of push him off to the side and say, yeah, he's, you know, he's a despicable kind of character. But actually to have a really stronger guy walk in and to make it just a little more interesting. I don't know if you understand what
I'm
saying.
Yeah, I do, but then the question, I would say that if you were met with this challenge, which is you've been sent by your neighborhood to come tell us to get out, you come into, you know, a black neighborhood, you're walking up into a tenement, I don't know how much bravado
right.
you
would
might
bring
have.
With all of that going no, on.
So, you know, there's the circumstances around it. But also, I'm not going to say that I feel for Carl Lindner at all. I can't say that I do that entirely, but the man is in a tough position. He has been sent, whether he believes what he believes or not, this is a tough gig. It's a tough gig to come to people's houses and say, you know what, we just don't want you. We don't want you here. And we're going to, we're,
do you think
we
you
don't
could
want
have had the choice of saying, you do it.
Yeah. But I think that's the point. That's what she's saying. Like, hey, if it were you.
Brenda, we're starting to run out of time, but I wanted to ask you a question about, did it take somebody, did it take a woman, Lorraine Hansberry, to write a play where women are so powerful and dominate the screen as they do in this play? Or could it have been written by a man? Could Raising the Sun been written by a man?
Nope. Of course it could have been written by a man. You know, brilliance is brilliance.
You disagree, Crystal.
Yes, I disagree.
Tell us why.
But it was Lorraine Hansberry who was chosen to give us A Raisin in the Sun. I think it's as simple as that. And we celebrate her and her brilliance. We're very grateful, just like we are grateful for all of our American playwrights. Or playwrights everywhere.
If she walked through the Recknitz Theater doors right now, I always like to ask this near the end of things, to take us back to people that we haven't had the chance to meet or talk to. What would you say to her tonight as you're going through, Lena?
I thank you for such a beautifully written role for an African-American actress.
Would you have a question for her?
I can't think of a question that I would necessarily have for her. I would be very, very anxious for her to be somewhere in the theater where I wouldn't be able to see her and to do my very best as Lena for her. And then we discuss what she saw and what she felt. I did a play recently for the second time, Intimate Apparel, and we were very fortunate enough to have Lynn Nottage, who is a Pulitzer Prize winner twice, and she was there for our opening night. And the look on her face and the comments that she had for our company in Princeton that night, I will take those comments with me always. Lynn Nottage is a brilliant playwright. And for that to happen. So questions, no. I think all of the conversation I would need would be for the work to be done, for the playwright to take in what she would see or he would see with my work.
Carl Cofield, as people maybe even leave tonight without even seeing the play, but after they do see the play here, which runs from September 9th through October 8th at Two River Theater, what's the conversation you want to have, hear them have, either in the lobby, as they're driving home, talking to their children, talking to their spouse? What would make you happy?
That they're not asking about how to validate their parking.
That's
has touched them in a profound way that starts conversation. I don't care where the conversation leads. I wouldn't want to control it, but we start a dialogue. I will say, personally, in this political climate, with monuments being torn down, I do think the saving grace in there is that we are having, as Brandon and Crystal and Brenda said earlier, we're having tough conversations that need to happen. We have to talk, no matter how painful they are. If there's a silver lining in all of this, we're having tough conversations. And to me, that is the import of the art.
Willie Durden is out in the audience. He plays Bobo, your dad. How amazing is it to have your dad on stage with you?
Oh, man.
I mean, we were going to have him on the panel, but Brandon said, please. He will air all the dirty laundry, and we can't have him up here.
Yeah, dad would air the dirty laundry.
How does it impact you?
For me to be coming back to Two River, a place that feels like home to me now. I mean, I've done a play here every year since 2012, so for the last 5 years. And to be welcomed back as family and be bringing family with me, well, you know, with Jason and I doing Top Dog, Underdog, and Crystal coming in, and And now I finally get to bring the patriarch. You know, my dad, Jason, and I often refer to him as like the Richard Williams Venus and Serena's dad. You know, that's my dad. But you'll never get to see Richard Williams playing competitive tennis, right? But you're gonna get to see my dad. You're gonna get to see him, you know swinging up here, and you're gonna see. It's really hard for me to talk about it because I don't think I've quite accepted the magnitude of it and the impact it's having in my life currently and that it will have. I mean, here's my dad, and since he's not up here, I get to air the dirty laundry. Here's a man who had five kids growing up in Houston, Texas, who loved acting, loved the craft of acting, the purity of acting, not necessarily wanting to be a celebrity, right, but wanting to champion the art form of theater. And he had sons he could do that, but he, in his graciousness, in his selflessness, he took on a job in a career that he could do, but I can tell had no love for necessarily. He loved being able to provide for us, but you knew there was something else that he wanted to do. And he's been, you know, for many years retired from that particular job. But to come back now at the age of 72, to be making his Equity debut, joining the union, Actors Equity, and saying, I am a professional actor. It is... So beyond that, I mean, beyond him being my father and doing this, what it says is that it's never too late. It's never too late. And those dreams that I have that I want to achieve, here's my father continues to be an example for me at 72 to say, yes, I will. And I, you know, he didn't have to join the union, right? He's in Texas, a right to work state. I said, Dad, I'm telling too much. But I say, when I called him and asked him, I said, that's interesting, you coming to do the show here. Would you like to do it? And he says, well, would I get to join the union? And I say, yeah, but you live in Texas, a right to work state. You don't have to join the union. I said, you plan on doing some more perfection acting? He goes, it's not about that. He goes, I just want to be able to put that in my obituary.
Oh, my God.
Right. So, I mean, to still at this age... Yeah. He's done. He doesn't have to do anything else. He raised five kids and we're good. He's got grandkids. I mean, we're okay. But to take on these personal objectives and goals and to say yes, I will do that. I will go into that unknown territory because I wanted to do it, and now the time has come, and I will take that. It's such a lesson for me.
Is it a hugging family, Crystal? Do they hug a lot?
Yes. Yes, definitely.
Well, after hearing all four of you talk, I think I speak for all of us. We are really looking forward to a raisin in the sun. John Dias couldn't be with us tonight, but I will announce that a new show that will be coming up next year, it's called The Chase Durden Story. Where at that time, four-year-old Chase goes through all kinds of experiences. And he will be here joining us for a live discussion.
Yes,
and
no,
is that?
Yeah, it's all about how he quits the family business
and becomes an architect.
Yeah.
He works with Grandpa. It's a great story, and we know that you'll enjoy it. But on behalf of everybody here at Two River Theater, and of course the wonderful Joan and Robert Recknitz who have joined us tonight, right here in their own theater. I want to thank the director, Carl Cofield. Brenda Presley, I can't wait to see you as Lena.
Thank you.
Crystal A. Dickinson. Ruth Younger. She'll never be the same after this show, remember. And Brandon J. Durden as Walter Lee Younger. I'm Doug Doyle. I want to thank all of you for taking, you know, an hour or so out of your time to really find out more about A Raisin in the Sun. Once again, it runs through September 9th through October 8th right here on this stage. Thanks so much for joining us on WBGO. Have a wonderful evening, everyone.